This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 19th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you the best interviews and reports of the past week from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, we'll find out why the coup in Burkina Faso could have diplomatic consequences for Taiwan.
For a long time, Taiwan was playing a kind of game of cat and mouse with mainland China, the People's Republic, to see who could persuade the most countries to recognize them diplomatically. If you recognize Taiwan, you can't recognize China, and vice versa.
We will hear from Bangkok, where the military junta threatens to imprison critics of the government in an attitude adjustment program.
While the outside world maintains this image of Thailand as being a very quiet, peaceful, tropical paradise holiday destination, it really is now no longer that.
We will also discuss the latest on the European car industry, look at Brazil's president Dilma Rousseff's struggle to gain more popularity, and we hear why the world's biggest beer conglomerate may be about to be born. All that and much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Markus Hippi. We start today in Asia. The leader of Thailand's military junta has threatened to imprison critics of the government in an attitude adjustment program. Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha blurted out the threat when he was asked by journalists about the welfare of two politicians who had been taken into army custody. The general is known to be thin-skinned and has earned reputation for lashing out against the media since he led a coup last year. Bangkok-based journalist Tony Cheng explained more to Monocle's Tyke Enright on Monday's edition of The Globalist.
Well, as far as we understand, it's quite a civil sort of proceeding, as it were, in that the people who are invited, and I say that in inverted commas, by the military to accompany them, are taken away. This has happened in the past. A lot of people were taken just after the military coup. They're then kept in isolation, pretty much, but we understand treated quite well. Although many of those who've undertaken this process say there is quite a lot of psychological pressure exerted upon them. They're usually kept for between 5 and 7 days in the military base, where they will be spoken to by military officers of increasing seniority and rank. And basically, they will be told to toe the government line, told not to criticize, and basically pressured into going along with what the government said. Now, we saw this after the military coup. Hundreds of people were taken away. There was something of a lull, but it's certainly coming back again. The two politicians you mentioned before who have taken away last week, and we understand that a high-profile journalist, Pravit Rochadaprok, who works for the Nation English language newspaper, was taken away yesterday afternoon and is currently incommunicado in another military base. So General Prayut said this on Friday. He's clearly following through with actions as well, which is very disturbing.
Disturbing indeed. I mean, what impact has it actually had, do you think, on free debate, discourse in Thailand about the military junta?
Essentially, it stopped. It's as simple as that. And I think a lot of people come to Thailand. They think of Thailand as a paradise, a holiday destination. But what we've seen over the last 2 years since the military coup took place, and before actually, is really, I mean, there's a full military crackdown. People who oppose the government are taken away to military camps. Villagers who've tried to raise issues with the government about environmental concerns, land rights, all sorts of pollution issues, and at the moment, increasingly just poverty. We're seeing terrible problems in the countryside with the government trying to stop farmers from planting rice because of a drought and other environmental controls out of their control, it has to be said. But we're seeing just terrible poverty, and anyone who tries to stand up to the military government is silenced. With a visit, as we've seen in the case of several villagers, from troops in armored personnel carriers who've really forced them to shut up, to high-profile personalities being taken away and removed. Television stations have been shut down. high-profile editors have been pressured to toe the government line. For most Thais, I think anybody who wants to raise their head above the parapet does so with considerable concern about their own safety and that for those around them.
That was Bangkok-based journalist Tony Cheng speaking to Monica Stike Enright on Monday's edition of The Globalist. You are listening to the recap on Monocle 24. Australia got a new Prime Minister earlier this week. This obviously meant that Australia also got a new ex-Prime Minister. Tony Abbott is the third consecutive Australian leader to have been canned by their own party before serving a single complete term. He is only 57, but few see him having a successful comeback in the future. So once he has delivered the manuscript of the score-settling memoir, then what? This is what Andrew Muller asked from his guests Jeffrey Kaufman, journalist and commentator, and Alessio Patalano, senior lecturer in war studies at King's College London.
Abbott did, in his sort of red-eyed farewell address, say something which I thought was actually quite interesting and perceptive. He said, "Poll-driven panic has produced a revolving door prime ministership which can't be good for our country, and a febrile media culture has developed that rewards treachery." Now, I don't think he's altogether wrong, and I think if you're trying to do a job like his in an age where you can't switch the media off, there's no escape from it. Is burnout and or insanity among political leaders going to become more of a problem?
I think, take note, Jeremy Corbyn, the new leader of the Labour Party here, that your caucus can turf you if they lose confidence in you. You know, these are volatile times. And yes, political leadership, anybody in the public eye lives under a microscope. And it's not easy. It's hard to sympathize with your recently departed prime minister.
That was basically his problem, I think.
You know, I read those words differently. He came across as a petty, mean-spirited, departing,
bitter guy, which is
exactly what he was. You know, he was petty, mean-spirited, and bitter when he was in office. And so, you know, I think he may be right about the circumstance, but he needs to look in the mirror. He didn't seem to acknowledge that any of the failings were his. And anyone in public life ultimately, you know, does have to take some responsibility for failures as well as successes.
Do either of you, and I ask you first, Alessio, do you have any particular favourite sort of ex-office holders? I mean, we've seen an interesting contrast in like the last few presidents. George W. Bush has barely been heard from, and Bill Clinton just will not go away.
But I think Tony Blair is the, you know, who wouldn't want to be Tony Blair? You get to mess up so badly and get paid millions to talk about it and consult. I mean, that's what I want.
Yeah, no, top that, you know, hands down, Tony Blair. It's a star in that sense, because he's the only person that is systematically sought after and paid for to tell about how he entangled all sorts of possible things. I suppose there's element to his dialectic. But you see, I think the point there, actually, that is a very interesting case if you think about it, because in this idea where everybody, every single prime minister is under microscope and you have to be very careful, you can either do the sort of Labour decision with Jeremy Corbyn, which is like you get defensive about it and you start basically going against everything that makes sense, right? Literally. I mean, you know, any sort of discussion about NATO and the UK or Trident, it looks like coming out of a script of 1975. It's just weird and out of touch with reality. So you either get on the defensive or you do the Tony Blair sort of option, which is you totally embrace it and you confuse people. And I think neither is good. But I think at the moment, what happened, I suppose what happened with Tony Abbott, is just that he got on that defensive and people just disliked him for it.
I do think it's interesting, though, to look at George W. Bush, who, not a man who I was particularly admiring of in office, but he has moved from the fast-paced world of being the most powerful man in the world to painting and cycling. And, you know, he's an oil painter.
Not a terrifically good one, in
fairness. No, but, you know, even more power to him. He's just having a nice old time, and he's not even that old either. But, you know, here's a guy, I keep thinking, is it because he knows he messed up so much, or is it because this is just who he is?
That was a highlight from Tuesday's edition of Midori House. Andrew Muller with his guests Jeffrey Kaufman, journalist and commentator, and Alessio Patalano, senior lecturer in war studies at King's College London. This is the recap on Monocle 24. It's time now for a highlight from Tuesday's edition of the Monocle Daily. Vale de São Paulo can lay claim to have one of the loudest voices in Brazil. The daily newspaper is one of the country's biggest sellers, and in the beginning of the week it used its voice to say something very unusual. It printed an editorial on the front page, giving the country's president one last chance. The paper insisted that Dilma Rousseff needs to take drastic measures to fix Brazil's problems. Those problems are, on the one hand, the vast corruption scandal which has shaken public life, and on the other, the enormous government overspend which has seen Brazil's debt rating plummet. This is what Monocle's regular contributor Bruno Carces discussed with Dominic Reynolds and Peter Cardwell.
I think the pressure on Dilma Rousseff has never been as big as it is now, because what's happening is that she's taking a criticism from all sides. She's also facing friendly fire now, because not only she will have to raise taxes, it seems like, but also the burden will come to, for instance, salary wages that were going to be raised are going to have to be postponed now. Pensions that were to be negotiated will also be postponed and so forth. So she's also facing friendly fire from the left, which we hadn't seen so much right now. But she doesn't have much room to maneuver. That's the problem. And calls for impeachment are growing day by day.
It seemed from afar that she's been in a lot of trouble for a very long time. You know, that she's had terrible poll ratings. She's had this corruption scandal around her neck. I wonder, to focus for a moment on this as a sort of bit of media theatre, to put this thing on the front page, is it forcing the question? Is it making Brazilians talk about this in a way that they haven't been?
I think Brazilians were talking about it. I think the editorial in itself, I think Folha is a newspaper more or less aligned with the center-right, and it is a bit of a mouthpiece for big businesses, and that's pretty much their view. They believe she has to raise taxes, otherwise there is no other alternative, and that's the view they expressed. That in itself, I think, is more of a piece of a bigger mosaic, which is the fact that she is now possibly living her worst possible moment since she was re-elected.
She's in a seriously tricky position then, but how vulnerable? You're saying it's interesting in terms of the impeachment calls. How teetering on the brink is she, do you think, at the moment? And is that newspaper editorial simply reflecting something rather than trying to push something ahead?
It's not clear. I mean, people have become more and more vocal calling for her to be impeached. But the big debate is whether that's legal or not, whether that is a coup to democracy, which her now very slim support base claims. But others say that the sustainability of the government itself is so slim that it cannot carry on as it is right now with a budget deficit. It presented a budget with an intentional deficit. It was a bit of a trick to lead Congress to act, to approve the budget and to find ways to mine that gap. So it's very hard to see what are her prospects in the foreseeable future. Perhaps 2 years from now, the economy can start to grow a little bit, but that's not enough for now.
Monocle's regular contributor Bruno Carces there in discussion with Dominic Reynolds and Peter Cardwell. That was the highlights from Tuesday's edition of the Monocle Daily. Up next, we are off to the Frankfurt IAA 2015 Motor Show. Stay tuned.
Travel in comfort with the help of the Monocle Shop. It's the place to select the best bags, passport wallets, travel guides, and, of course, the latest issue of the magazine to entertain you on your lounger. We have a great lineup of special collaboration bags with Porter in Japan, including the new Overnighter bag, ideal for a city weekend trip. And then there's the limited edition Remova multi-wheel, made from lightweight polycarbonate in a special Monocle edition. Visit our stores in London, New York, Toronto, Singapore, Tokyo, and Hong Kong. Or shop online at monocle.com. Be the one turning heads at the luggage carousel.
You are listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted here at Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. On Tuesday and Wednesday, the briefing was broadcast live from the Frankfurt IAA 2015 Motor Show. On Wednesday, I caught up with Chris Reiter, European automotive reporter for Bloomberg News, who gave us a roundup of what were the most significant product launches at Messe Frankfurt Conference Center.
In terms of advancements in the auto industry, I think you'll see a significant break with tradition. I mean, you have the Bentley Bentayga, which is the Bentley brand's first SUV. You have Jaguar presenting its first SUV. You have brands like Audi moving deliberately into the electric car market. You have Porsche also presenting an electric car. So it's just, to me, it's obvious a sign that the auto industry is facing radical change right now.
What do you think? Who are leading the market at the moment in terms of innovation? Who are the biggest innovators?
Well, right now, based on this show, you can say the Volkswagen Group is showing a lot of innovation. Porsche is part of the Volkswagen Group, and they presented here a car called the Mission E Concept. It's just a concept electric car, but it's a sports car. It's a little bit bigger than a 911. And it has really interesting technology in terms of it can charge up to 80% capacity in 15 minutes, which is half the time of a Tesla. It has a range of 500 kilometers, which is very competitive, a little bit better than the current Tesla model. And then it also has innovative features like gesture control. It has eye movement tracking, so it tracks your eyes to interact with the car. And it has holograms, so you can effectively like grab apps out of the air and interact with the car in that way. So that car alone has quite a significant innovations in it.
What do you think, how important are these kind of fairs for the car industry? I'm thinking that these massive brands, they surely can get the attention they want just with their own PR machinery.
Yeah, I mean, the brands have massive marketing budgets. They have massive reach. I mean, Audi, BMW, Mercedes, they're worldwide known brands. That said, they're all German. And they all like to compete with each other. And this gives them like, you know, one playing field where they all have to one-up each other. And that's what they do here. So whether it makes sense or not doesn't really matter.
You're actually now referring to that show of competition we see over here.
Yeah. Right behind us right now is a gigantic Audi stand, which is put together just for a couple weeks. And that would be a large building in its own right. And it's just put up for the stand and it'll be torn down in a couple weeks.
I mentioned elsewhere that I went to Mercedes-Benz's space and they had the biggest video screen I've seen so far in my life. It's about 40 times 20 right. meters large. So yeah. Do you think this is something that may put off smaller brands? I'm wondering, for example, why Volvo is not here this year.
Yeah, Volvo made a conscious decision not to come here. I mean, we actually visited Gothenburg a couple weeks ago. So they gave their own sort of like private screening of what they're up to today. And they had an interesting comment and said that the only point of them to come to Frankfurt would be they would only show us how much bigger Audi, Mercedes, and BMW are compared to Volvo. So they thought it was just a money-losing proposition and they have like better chances to reach customers in other ways.
Chris Wright, a European automotive reporter for Bloomberg News, speaking to me on Wednesday's edition of The Briefing that was broadcast from the IAA Motor Show in Frankfurt. You are listening to the recap on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. Popping out for a drink may be about to go to a whole new level, particularly if the brand you are buying is SAB Miller, not so much a beer as the second largest brewer in the world. Anheuser-Busch InBev, which takes the global top spot, is keen to purchase its rival, and a proposal to the SAB Miller board is in the offing. Should it get to the point where glasses are clinked and corks popped in celebration, the merged group would be responsible for around a third of universal annual beer consumption. That is a lot of hangovers. To unpick the details of that proposed deal, Monocle's Georgina Godwin spoke to beer writer and broadcaster Pete Brown and Jason Cryan from global economy website Quartz.
We're talking about hundreds of different brands across the world. I mean, if these companies combine, it's basically a third of global beer, and both of them are the products of a pretty steady trend of consolidation across the macro beer industry, if you want to call it that. Anheuser-Busch InBev is a Brazilian-Belgian-American conglomerate. SAB Miller is an Anglo-South African with a big American component as well. Just to give you some flavor, if the two companies do merge, they will control something like 60% of the U.S. beer market. That's bringing together brands like Bud, Miller, and Coors under one umbrella. That said, I doubt that would be allowed by the antitrust authorities.
Why is SAB Miller an attractive proposition?
SAB Miller is attractive to AB InBev because they have a commanding market share in some pretty attractive, fast-growing markets in South America, in Africa, a little bit in Eastern Europe that AB InBev doesn't have, and thus it just adds a bit more geography to them. Also, Anheuser-Busch is a more profitable company. They're able to produce these beers more efficiently. And so if they can sprinkle some of their magic onto SAB Miller and expand the profit margins there, then that gives them scope to make more money.
I'd like to bring Pete Brown into the discussion here. Pete's a beer and a pub writer. Pete, I gather you have very strong feelings about this proposed deal, and you say it would be a global disaster.
For the drinker, yes. Obviously, a lot of people are going to make an awful lot of money out of this, but I tend to see it from the sort of the street and the pub level up. And Jason's last point is why, really. AB InBev do perform very, very profitably indeed. And the way they do that is essentially asset stripping every single company that they buy. They are fanatical about cost cutting. And the thing about beer is it's a beverage that's made out of quality ingredients. If you cut costs in beer, you're going to cut quality in beer. And brands such as Budweiser, Stella Artois that AB InBev have bought in the past, as beers are now shadows of their former selves. They don't have the same attention to detail in the brewing process. They have poorer quality ingredients. They're sold as commodities rather than beer brands. And for me, beer is always a lot more special than commodity. Beer drinkers have some kind of magic, some kind of ownership over their beers. And AB InBev tend to treat beer as they would treat detergent or dog food.
But SAB Miller not.
SAB Miller have had a slightly different approach in that they're a global brewer with global scope, but they recognise that beer is different when you go to different countries. There's no such thing as a global beer brand the way that you have maybe Coca-Cola or Pepsi or Starbucks. Every country you go to, yeah, brands like Heineken or Guinness may have a foothold there, but if you go to a different country, there's a different beer brand there because people love their local beer, they love their national beer. And SAB Miller understand that and get that. So when you look at the way they operate in different regions around the world, they're very sensitive to the little wrinkles in that region, whether it be the way people drink beer, the brand loyalty there and so on. Whereas AB InBev have this kind of global template that they want to kind of standardise and uniform across the planet.
How much of this consolidation of huge macro breweries do you think has to do with the craft movement gaining a bigger market share? Are the little guys threatening the big ones?
I think yes, they are. I don't think that has much to do with this particular deal. The big guys like SAB, AB InBev are doing other things with craft. They're trying to buy into craft. They're worried because beer, largely because of the actions of people like AB InBev, mainstream beer, those big brands, those big lager brands, are becoming very commoditized. They get bought on price deals. They're often sold on promotion. Craft is the only sector within beer in sort of developed mature markets where people are interested in the stories behind the beers and the traditions and the ingredients and so on. And they operate in quite a different way than the big guys do. And so the big guys, I mean, AB InBev have bought people like Goose Island and other big craft breweries. My hope there is that they recognise that the whole point, the whole reason these guys are much more successful than they are in engaging drinkers is they do things in a different way. And if they allow them to carry on doing that in a different way, that's great. But people are kind of worried about that. That's what always worries drinkers when a deal like that goes through.
Monocle's Georgina Godwin there speaking to Jason Kryan from global economy website Quartz and beer writer and broadcaster Pete Brown on Thursday's edition of The Globalist. You are listening to the recap on Monocle 24, and it's time now for a highlight from Friday's briefing. It might not seem that there would be any particular reason for a coup in Burkina Faso to prompt the sounding of action stations in the Foreign Ministry of Taiwan, but Taipei lost no time in issuing a statement that its relations with the West African country would be unaffected. The reason for their haste was that Burkina Faso is one of only 22 countries worldwide which still recognize Taiwan rather than China. Monocle's Andrew Müller spoke to John Everard, who knows a lot about conducting diplomacy from a position of isolation. In a distinguished career with the British Foreign Office, John Everard was desk officer for Taiwan and ambassador to Belarus and North Korea.
For a long time, Taiwan was playing a kind of game of cat and mouse with mainland China, the People's Republic, to see who could persuade the most countries to recognize them diplomatically. If you recognize Taiwan, you can't recognize China, and vice versa. When the game started in the 1970s, Taiwan effectively held all the cards. The vast majority of countries recognized Taiwan, not the People's Republic. But of course, that was a long time ago. We're now down to 22. Why does it matter to Taiwan? Because it gives it what Taiwan calls diplomatic space. It gives it a kind of diplomatic presence internationally. It gives it a certain amount of prestige. It gives it people who will tend to vote in Taiwan's interests in the big debates of the day. And if relations with China ever start to go backwards, and of course we have a presidential election coming up in Taiwan, which the opposition may well win, then having these kind of bargaining chips in a negotiation with China tends to be rather important.
I was in Taiwan about 10 years ago, I think. I met the then Foreign Minister Tan Sun Chen. This was back when Taiwan had 25 official friends. That was the number of flags flying outside his ministry. I counted them. They're now down to 22. Why are they running out of friends? Is it just the irresistible momentum of the size of the People's Republic?
Money. This is cash diplomacy. Both Taiwan and the People's Republic try to bribe clients with significant amounts of money to switch sides. The People's Republic, for example, has been offering Swaziland literally billions of dollars in aid if it will defect from the Taiwan camp, but Swaziland has refused to do so. Gambia is an interesting case. In 2013, Gambia severed relations with Taiwan, and everybody assumed that this was because China had made Gambia an offer it couldn't resist. But it still hasn't established relations with China, which suggests that a kind of bidding war is still going on between the two.
There's also the interesting case of a few African countries, Lesotho, Liberia and Niger, which have gone back and forth.
That's right, depending on who's offering the best price on the day. I mean, if you are sitting in Jemena, do you really care whether you recognise China or Taiwan?
Not in the least, I wouldn't have thought.
Not in the least. It all comes down to who's going to write you the biggest cheque.
From the position of Taiwan, and the Foreign Minister Tan Sun Chen back in 2005 was very explicit about Taiwan's ambitions, and he did say the more countries that recognise you, it's exactly as you were saying, the greater prestige you have, the greater legitimacy you have in the eyes of the world. And of course, other countries do maintain conveniently hypocritical relations with Taiwan. They just don't call their missions their embassies. They call them business offices or cultural offices or whatever. But how hard is it? How difficult is it? Because there are some countries that seem to manage okay. Switzerland didn't even join the UN until 2002.
Well, that's right. Joining the UN is a fairly cheap way of establishing diplomatic presence. It also means that even if you can't afford to run embassies, embassies cost money, that you can conduct business with other countries just by wandering around the corridors and talking to other missions. So it's a fairly cost-effective thing to go and do. Switzerland hesitated because it was afraid that joining the UN would compromise Swiss neutrality and they had to have a vote on it. Yeah, but coming back to the point you make about Taiwan, other countries managed to keep a presence in Taiwan kind of under the radar. From time to time, Beijing protests and demands that a country either closes its office or downgrade the representation or backs away from a trade deal of one kind or another. Most countries have managed to fend off Beijing's criticisms. A couple of times they've had to scale back a bit. But by and large, people understand what the rules of the game are, and by and large, they work.
When a country is isolated, though, and you did work in North Korea, which is about as isolated as a country gets, does that isolation by the rest of the world, especially when it is a kind of a punitive isolation, does it ever improve a country's behaviour? The line that keeps coming back to me was a friend of mine in Belgrade during the sanctions on Milosevic, who just asked, what good does the West think is going to come of locking us in a cage with a maniac?
Yes, I think in the case of Serbia, that was a very fair comment. Does it improve behaviour? I mean, I have to say that Taiwan has been an impeccable global player, whether that is because or despite its isolation, I mean, we could discuss for a very long time. On the other hand, North Korea offered a kind of global opening when it was allowed to join the United Nations along with South Korea in 1991, simply blew it. There was a period of several years where the world was perfectly happy to talk to North Korea, do deals with it and work out some kind of accommodation. But no, the North Koreans weren't having it. And of course, we're now into the kind of downward spiral we were talking about just last night. So a lot depends on your behaviour, which isn't necessarily directly influenced by the degree of isolation.
That was Monocle's Andrew Müller speaking to John Everard, the former British ambassador to Belarus and North Korea. And that's all we've got time for in this week's episode of The Recap. The show was edited by Wei Dong Lin and Nina Norek. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Markus Hippi, thank you for listening. Goodbye.